is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details. And now we enlighten you with verses 162 to 165 of chapter Al-An'am from the Holy Quran, recited by Murtaza Fatemi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. قل إن صلاتي ونسكي ومحياي ومماتي لله رب العالمين لا شريك له وبذلك أمرت وأنا أول المسلمين قل أغير الله أبغي ربا وهو رب كل شيء ولا تكسب كل نفس إلا عليها ولا تزر وازرة وزر أخرى ثم إلى ربكم مرجعكم فينبئكم
In the name of God, the Compassionate, the Merciful. Say, surely my prayer and my sacrifice and my life and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. No associate has He, and this am I commanded, and I am the first of those who submit. Say, what shall I seek, a Lord other than Allah? And He is the Lord of all things, and no soul earns evil but against itself, and no bearer of burden shall bear the burden of another. Then to your Lord is your return, so He will inform you of that in which you differed. And He it is who has made you successors in the land, and raised some of you above others by various grades, that He might try you by what He has given you. Surely, your Lord is quick to requite evil, and He is most surely the forgiving, the merciful.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's foreign minister slams the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden for sticking to its predecessor's policy of imposing illegal sanctions against Iran. Moscow says the new military pact between Australia, Britain, and the U.S. is a hostile step aimed not only at China, but also at Russia. Also, pressure mounts on the U.S. president both at home and abroad over the handling of migrants, mainly Haitian nationals, massing along the Mexican border.
Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. Thank you for joining us. Beginning with our top story, Iran has reiterated that the talks in Vienna between the Islamic Republic and the remaining parties to the 2015 nuclear deal are simply aimed at bringing the United States back to full compliance with the accord. Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian made the comment as he met his German counterpart Heiko Maas in New York City on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly. Amir Abdollahian said the U.S. should know that all trade-offs have already been made in the course of negotiations that led to the multilateral pact. He added that the Vienna talks are not meant to strike a new nuclear deal. Rather, they seek to ensure a guaranteed return of the U.S. to the agreement after its unilateral pullout in 2018. Amir Abdollahian also met EU Foreign Policy Chief Josep Borrell. He told Borrell that the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is following in its predecessor's footsteps by keeping sanctions on Iran in place. The top diplomat slammed the U.S. policy as non-constructive. Well, the Iran nuclear deal was one of the topics raised by world leaders as they spoke at the 76th United Nations General Assembly session. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi addressed the session too, rejecting U.S. hegemony and oppressive sanctions. Here's more.
As the 76th annual session of the United Nations General Assembly kicked off in New York, world leaders discussed a myriad of topics of global concern. This year, like the past few years, the fate of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal and anti-Tehran sanctions were among the issues mentioned in the speeches. In his first address to the Assembly as the U.S. president, Joe Biden reiterated his administration's position on the nuclear deal, also known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA.
The United States remains committed to preventing Iran from gaining a nuclear weapon. We're working with the P5 plus one to engage Iran diplomatically and to seek a return to JCPOA. We're prepared to return to full compliance if Iran does the same.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi, who was also speaking for the first time to the UN General Assembly, said Tehran has no trust in U.S. promises and noted that his country will welcome talks that would lead to the complete removal of sanctions against Tehran.
The Islamic Republic considers as useful talks whose ultimate outcome is the lifting of all oppressive sanctions. While decisively defending all its rights and the interests of its people, Iran is keen to have large-scale political and economic cooperation and convergence with the rest of the world.
He slammed the restrictions, particularly during the COVID-19 pandemic, as tantamount to crimes against humanity. Elsewhere in his remarks, President Raisi said the time for exercising hegemony and violating the will of nations have long passed.
This year, two scenes made history. One was on January the 6th, when the U.S. Congress was attacked by the people, and two, when the people of Afghanistan were dropped down from the U.S. planes in August. From the capital to Kabul, one clear message was sent to the world. The United States' hegemonic system has no credibility, whether inside or outside the country. What is seen in our region today proves that not only the hegemon and the idea of hegemony, but also the project of imposing westernized identity have failed miserably.
The Iranian president said, pursuing hegemony results in bloodshed, instability, and ultimately defeat and retreat. He noted that the U.S. isn't withdrawing from Iraq and Afghanistan, but is being ousted. President Raisi's remarks appear to be setting the tone for the upcoming Vienna talks aimed at reviving the JCPOA, which are due to resume over the next few weeks. Iran says it doesn't want anything beyond its rights, that is, the implementation of international law.
Political commentator Mark Weber believes Washington's anti-Tehran sanctions constitute a breach of international law. Listen.
Well, the remarks by the Iranian president are quite right. The sanctions policy of the Biden administration, which is continuing the sanctions policy of the Trump administration, is a form of economic warfare. It's contrary not only to international law, but also to the principle of global cooperation that President Biden says he wants to uphold and claims to respect. But the actual record is very different. You know, the sanctions policy is contrary to the, of course, 2015 Iran nuclear deal, which represents a world consensus. But this deal is not one that the United States really has under international law the right to disobey. It's a United Nations Security Council resolution. All member states of the United Nations are obliged to uphold and follow United Nations Security Council resolutions. So when the Biden administration talks on the one side of its mouth about international cooperation and the rule of law, and on the other hand continues the sanctions against Iran, it is speaking hypocritically. It's not showing by actions that it really means what it says in words. And that's a very bad thing.
Moscow says the new trilateral military pact between Australia, Britain, and the U.S. is a hostile step aimed not only at China, but also at Russia. The Secretary of Russia's Security Council denounced the deal, dubbed AUKUS, as yet another military bloc aimed at confronting the two non-Western powers. Nikolai Patrushev said, the accord will see the U.S. and U.K. team up with Australia to station nuclear submarines deep down in the Pacific Ocean, posing a threat to the entire security architecture in Asia. The new partnership has also infuriated France, as it saw Australia scrap a multi-billion-dollar submarine deal with Paris. France has also slammed the pact as a stab in the back and recalled its ambassadors to Canberra and Washington. Political commentator William Jones says the trilateral military partnership is a step forward in a very aggressive policy that upsets the balance of power internationally.
Well, obviously, this is very dramatic and it kind of upsets the apple cart. People who were hoping for a much better U.S.-China relationship, I think, have got another thing coming. It also upsets the whole balance of power internationally. I mean, having nuclear-powered submarines is a power issue, regardless of whether or not they are nuclear weapons submarines. It's a step forward in a very aggressive policy directed against China and also directed against Russia. And I think there will be repercussions because although soft words were spoken today by President Biden at the United Nations about there's going to be no Cold War, I think people feel that this is a step in that direction. He's talking the talk about peace and working together with China, but he's not walking the walk. He's walking in the direction of conflict. In Europe, of course, already there is seen as a major breach with the United States. They may decide to go their own way. What way that will be is hard to say. Will it be an independent defense structure? Maybe they'll become closer to China and Russia simply in order to avoid the kind of conflict that the U.S. is moving forward on with regard to this move.
Well, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden is facing criticism both at home and abroad over its handling of migrants massing along the Mexican border. Republicans have cited lax security, while Democrats expressed concern about the humanitarian situation at the border. Some 14,000 asylum seekers, majority of them from Haiti, have been camping under a bridge in Texas since last week. Several hundred have already been deported to Haiti, and thousands more have been moved into detention. The move has sparked criticism, with several UN agencies calling for an end to the mass expulsion of migrants. In a statement, the UN refugee chief said he was shocked by images of the deplorable conditions of migrants. Filippo Grandi said expulsions of individuals are inconsistent with international norms. Earlier, the UN Human Rights Office also voiced concern over the plight of asylum seekers. U.S. Democratic lawmakers have removed $1 billion in military aid for Israel from a draft version of legislation to fund the American government. The funding for Israel's Iron Dome missile system was in a provision originally included in a bill to keep the federal government funding. But the provision was deleted from a subsequent version after progressive lawmakers said they would oppose the measure if it was included. The lawmakers objected to the provision, citing Palestinian casualties during the most recent Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip in May. The U.S. House is debating a piece of legislation to fund the federal government through December the 3rd and raise the nation's borrowing limit to avert a possible government shutdown. Wyatt Reed, our correspondent in Washington, D.C., says the U.S. removing more than $1 billion in military aid for Israel is humiliating for the regime.
A huge humiliation for Israel. In terms of the United States Congress, they pretty much get a blank check in general. They more or less kind of ask and ye shall receive type relationship. So this is very significant. The fact that lawmakers like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, Rashida Tlaib, Mark Pocan were reportedly able to negotiate with House Speaker Nancy Pelosi and to eliminate this $1 billion in funding for the Iron Dome. That is funding that every year, as part of an agreement signed under President Obama, Washington hands over, really no strings attached, so that the Israeli regime can defend its citizens whenever it attacks Palestinians from errant rockets. Now, obviously, this is a big deal in that sense, right? That somebody would stand up and just tell Israel, look, you don't get something that you want. Obviously, this is incredibly significant. But I will say that it seems increasingly likely that this $1 billion in funding, rather than not going to Israel at all, will simply be included in the National Defense Authorization Act that comes before Congress in December.
Moving on, Muslim pilgrims are streaming into Iraq's holy city of Karbala ahead of the day of Arba'in. The pilgrims are joining the annual gathering that marks the 40th day after the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Hussein, the grandson of the Prophet Muhammad. This year, Arba'in falls on September the 28th. The event drew millions of people in the past years, but the Iraqi government has restricted the number of foreign visitors since last year due to the coronavirus pandemic. Imam Hussein and dozens of his companions were martyred in an unequal battle with troops of the tyrant ruler of their time over 13 centuries ago. The battle, known as the Ashura event, is one of the most important religious occasions marked by Muslims. Yemenis across the country have marked the 7th anniversary of a revolution they say ended U.S. hegemony in their country. Tens of thousands filled the streets in different cities to commemorate the revolution that took place on September the 14th, 2014. Abdul Latif al-Washili has more in this report.
Yemenis from all walks of life took to the streets of the capital Sana'a to commemorate the revolution that took place on September 21st, 2014. Following that revolution, the government of the former President Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi collapsed.
The 21st September revolution means freedom and independence for us, which prompted 17 countries led by Saudi Arabia to launch a war on Yemen on 26 March 2015. This revolution is a resistance against the Israeli project in the region and a resistance against Saudi Arabia's miscalculations, which is prevalent in our country. So today we are paying the price for our freedom.
Our protest is in response to the call of the leader of the Ansarullah movement, and it is a commemoration of the anniversary of the 21st September revolution, during which Yemenis gained freedom, independence, and sovereignty of their country.
Protesters said the revolution was triggered by the Yemenis themselves without any foreign intervention as a result of the deterioration of living conditions under the rule of the former president.
This large demonstration is evidence of the growing awareness among the Yemenis of the need to get out of the state of exclusion that prevailed under the rule of the former regime. The 21st September revolution saved Yemenis from external domination, and Yemenis today own their decision. The battles that are taking place today between Yemeni army and the Saudi-backed forces are the result of the Yemenis' exit from Saudi control.
We came out today to announce to the world that the September 21st revolution is the revolution of all free Yemenis, and to affirm our rejection of foreign domination and our boycott of proxies and traitors, whether in Yemen or the rest of the Arab countries.
Abd Rabbu Mansur Hadi was backed by Saudi Arabia, that even waged an ongoing war to reinstate him. The Saudi-led war on the country has killed tens of thousands of civilians and displaced millions of others since 2015.
Yemenis say their revolution was aimed at preserving the sovereignty of their country, which was under the control of the U.S. and Saudi proxies. They believe that the Saudi brutal rule on their country is the price for the freedom they have gained. Abd Latif al-Washali, Sana'a.
Australians hold a third day of protests in Melbourne against COVID-19 lockdown curbs and vaccines amid heavy police presence. Police have beefed up security and pledged to prevent violent protests. Several demonstrators have been arrested. On Tuesday, over 2,000 protesters rallied in Melbourne, damaging property and injuring three police officers. More than 60 protesters were arrested. Riot police used pepper spray and rubber ball grenades to break up the protest. Melbourne has been under lockdown for 7 weeks as it struggles to curb an outbreak of the Delta variant of COVID-19.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Thank you.
supplication on Wednesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, who appointed the night to be a garment, and sleep for a rest, and day he appointed for a rising. To thee belongs praise, for thou roused me from my sleep. And hadst thou willed, thou wouldst have made it everlasting, an everlasting praise that will never be cut off, and whose number the creatures will never count. O Allah, to thee belongs praise, for thou created, then proportioned, and ordained, and decreed, and gave death, and bestowed life, and made sick and healed, and made well and afflicted, and sat upon the throne and encompassed the kingdom. I supplicate thee with the supplication of one whose mediation is weak, whose stratagems have been cut off, whose term has drawn near, whose expectation from this world has shrunk, whose neediness for thy mercy has intensified, whose remorse for his neglect has become great, whose slips and stumbles have become many, and whose repentance is devoted sincerely to thy face. So bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and his household, the good, the pure. And provide me with the intercessions of Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, and deprive me not of his companionship. Surely thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, decree for me on Wednesday four things. Induce me to be strong in obedience to thee, to be joyful in worshipping thee, to be desirous of thy reward, and to abstain from that which would make incumbent upon me thy painful punishment. Thou art gentle to whom thou wilt.
The limelight.
The European Union is demanding answers and an apology from Australia over its treatment of France as the fallout from the AUKUS announcement threatens to delay a key trade deal. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Guardian journalist Amy Remekis. The piece is titled AUKUS Row: European Union demands apology from Australia over France's treatment before trade talks. The European Union is demanding answers and an apology from Australia over its treatment of France as the fallout from the AUKUS announcement threatens to delay a key trade deal. Australia hopes of entering into a free trade agreement with the European Union hit rough waters with the EU Commission President Ursula von der Leyen demanding Australia explain its conduct in defence of EU member state France. The Scott Morrison government announced it was cancelling its $90 billion Australian dollar submarine contract with the French and entering into a forever partnership with the United States and the United Kingdom in a new agreement known as AUKUS late last week. The French claim to have been blindsided by the announcement. Despite attempts to soothe the diplomatic row, the French recalled their ambassador and have asked the European Union to reconsider Australia's involvement in a free trade deal with the EU. While trade talks with Australia are expected to continue as planned, Ursula von der Leyen said Australia had some explaining to do first. One of our member states has been treated in a way that is not acceptable, and so we want to know what happened and why, von der Leyen said in an interview with CNN. Therefore, you first of all clarify that before you keep on going with business as usual. The chair of the European Parliament's Committee on International Trade, Bernd Lange, continued that theme in an interview with ABC on Tuesday. It is really an unkind situation France is faced with, he said, adding that he expected to see some kind of apology, some kind of de-escalation of the situation from the Australian government to help for better understanding. The question of trust is now occurring, and some members could ask for more safety nets, for more safeguards, he said. European leaders will meet in New York to consider the response to the axing of the French deal in favor of the AUKUS pact. U.S. President Joe Biden has asked for talks with French President Emmanuel Macron in an attempt to mend relations. The French have agreed to a phone conversation in the coming days. Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison, who is in New York ahead of his first meeting with Joe Biden, said there was no opportunity at this time for his own talks with Emmanuel Macron. I'm sure that opportunity will come in time, he said from New York. Right now, I understand the disappointment, and they're working through the consultations with their ambassador's return to Paris and will be patient with that. Scott Morrison said he took heart from European Commission Foreign Affairs head Josep Borrell's comments to not mix apples and pears last week when it came to Australia's involvement in the EU free trade agreement. I think that's a pretty good summary of the situation, Scott Morrison said. I mean, these issues will be worked through in the weeks and months ahead. It's not an easy thing to do, to get an agreement with the European Union on trade. I think everyone understands that. While French anger continues to simmer, Australia's diplomats have been working overtime to reassure Australia's partners in the Indo-Pacific that the AUKUS deal will not affect the region. Scott Morrison spoke with Indonesian President Joko Widodo on his way to New York to assure him of Indonesia's key areas of interest, including that Australia would maintain all of our obligations under the Non-Proliferation Treaty and the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Regime, and that the AUKUS agreement would contribute to peace and stability and a strategic balance in the region. Australia will send a team to Indonesia to issue further briefings on what the new strategic agreement will mean. The phone call came on the back of the Australia's ambassador to ASEAN, sending a statement to Southeast Asian nations reiterating Australia's commitment to ASEAN goals, while reiterating AUKUS was not a defense alliance or defense pact. Australia last week cancelled its order of a fleet of conventional submarines from France and said it would instead build at least 8 nuclear-powered submarines with United States and British technology, prompting a recall by France of its envoys in the United States and Australia.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Communique.
A suicide bomber has killed 170 people and wounded another 200 after carrying out a terrorist attack outside Kabul's international airport. The tragic event unfolded as thousands of people tried to escape the country with mass evacuations underway, part of the overall effort of withdrawal by U.S. troops from America's longest war. In the lead-up to the tragic attack, Australia, Britain, and the U.S. all warned their citizens to stay away from the airport, saying that an attack was imminent. Now, some are asking, how come the U.S. and its allies didn't do more to secure the perimeter if they did indeed have prior knowledge of an impending attack? Others are asking, why did the U.S. abandon its biggest airbase, Bagram, just a month before? And could that have potentially contributed to such a security situation? Let's take a closer look. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique. As part of the withdrawal agreement signed in February 2020 by then-U.S. President Donald Trump, the United States was set to leave Afghanistan on May 1st, 2021. It did not. Instead, U.S. President Joe Biden pushed the deadline forward to September 11th, marking the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, and then back to August 31st. It said that in order to avoid a Saigon moment, a repeat of the humiliating withdrawal from Vietnam in 1975, the U.S. moved all evacuation operations from its embassy in Kabul to Kabul's international airport. Air traffic control and all operations at the airport were taken over by U.S. forces, effectively grinding all commercial flights to a halt. Now, some people, like Eric Prince, the founder of the infamous Blackwater mercenary group, which committed numerous war crimes in Iraq, are even trying to exploit the situation by offering people a ticket out of the country, but only if they cough up around $6,500 for a seat on a plane. The lines are long, the crowds are packed, people are desperate to get out of the country that the U.S. claims it was building and bettering for 20 years. And in the early hours of August 26th, there were warnings from the British, American, and Australians that a terrorist attack at Kabul airport was imminent. These warnings, unfortunately, turned out to be true, and a suicide bomber blew themselves up amidst a crowd of people, tragically killing 170 Afghans, 13 U.S. Marines, and wounding 200 people. And even though the majority of victims are Afghans, you wouldn't really know that if you only paid attention to what Western media are saying. In what can only be described as American arrogance, many headlines, tweets, and messages of outrage and concern do not even mention the Afghans killed, who make up most of the victims. You know, these stories seem to completely omit this in their headlines, focusing heavily instead on the U.S. Marines, asking you to pray for them, as if they are the only victims worth mentioning, and the Afghans aren't worth praying for. You even had outrageous, hate-filled messages like this one of people calling for Afghan villages to be wiped off the face of the earth for every American life. It's always interesting in moments like these to see the mask come off the people who claim the U.S. is supposedly helping Afghanistan or occupying it for humanitarian reasons. Unfortunately, this gruesome and barbaric attack is not an isolated incident. It is a tragic reminder of the entire war on Afghanistan, because not just yesterday, but for the last 20 years, many people have been killed, many people have been wounded and suffered as a result of U.S. imperialism. Since the beginning of this year alone, in the last 7 months, almost 1,700 Afghans were killed. Did you hear about any of that in the news? The mainstream media only seem to care about victims when they are NATO troops or Western citizens, because their lives are somehow worth more than anyone else's. Their entire coverage has focused primarily on how bad the withdrawal is, precisely so you forget how bad the war is. They don't want to talk about Guantanamo Bay, Abu Ghraib, the CIA kidnapping and torturing people, the executions, the war crimes by British, American, and Australian troops. This is deeply embarrassing and shameful for them and blows their entire narrative about nation building and counterterrorism out of the water. So instead, they try to distract you with this withdrawal so you forget the war crimes. All week, the Department of Defense has been posting pure propaganda, showing photographs of U.S. soldiers giving water to Afghans or holding Afghan babies. right? As if those same NATO troops weren't the ones who killed and maimed over 26,000 children between 2005 and 2019, right? Like we're just supposed to forget about all these war crimes and crimes against humanity and all the victims and refugees they created over 20 years of war because of some pictures of bottled water. What a cheap attempt to try and whitewash their crimes. And immediately after this attack at Kabul Airport, General H.R. McMaster went on CNN for an interview. McMaster used to be the National Security Advisor under Trump, and he represents the typical war hawk neocon ghouls who inhabit the national security blob in D.C. McMaster went on CNN, and take a look at what he had to say.
I would not be surprised in any way if ISIS-K was used, their Kabul attack network was used as a cutout for the Taliban. Mm. So they can humiliate us on the way out and still continue to play us.
And if you know nothing about Afghanistan and you know nothing about Daesh and the Taliban, which is most of CNN's audience, then you might be inclined to believe this man who boasts a long career in the military and is on TV wearing a suit and a tie. But his claim that the Taliban is somehow behind this attack is simply ridiculous and fantasy. The Taliban want to finish this war and for all foreign NATO invaders to leave Afghanistan as soon as possible. The last thing on earth that the Taliban is going to do is execute a suicide mission, kill 13 Marines, not to mention dozens of their own people, hundreds of their own people, and risk prolonging the war or escalating the conflict with the U.S. Not to mention the very obvious fact that the Taliban and Daesh are enemies. So why on earth would they be working together, let alone on such an endeavor at this time? Again, this is such an absurd statement that only someone who knows nothing about the region could believe. This is very reminiscent of 2002 and 2003, of how the U.S. lied about Saddam Hussein having ties to Al-Qaeda, even though the two were also enemies. This was a complete fabrication, a lie, in order to implicate him in the war on terror and try and justify an invasion of Iraq. In another example, just last year in the summer of 2020, the mainstream media claimed that Russia and Iran had placed bounties on U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan and were basically paying the Taliban thousands of dollars to kill U.S. forces. And of course, this story turned out to be completely fake, because that's what it is. It's a baseless lie. And nevertheless, it was successfully used by the politicians in Washington, D.C. to prolong the war in Afghanistan, despite the fact that at the time, many people warned how improbable and fake the story sounded, not to mention that its sources were unnamed intelligence officials who, needless to say, have a never-ending list of lies that they have told for political gain. So perfectly aligned with these numerous past examples, General McMaster goes on CNN and makes up an outrageous lie claiming the Taliban and Daesh, who are enemies, work together to attack the U.S. The only reason people like him say this, and the only reason networks like CNN allow him to say this, is because they hope to prolong the war. They love war. They love the ratings, the money, and the expansion of U.S. hegemony, and that's precisely why they do it. We'll be right back after this short break.
Communique is a program in which Richard Medhurst, the independent journalist and political commentator, gives his views of controversial issues of our time and interviews famous politicians and personalities.
Well, Dr. Wahab, an Afghan-American professor who's taught at Lewis and Clark College, he was also the senior advisor to the Minister of Higher Education in Afghanistan for 5 years, from 2002 to 2007. He joins me now to discuss the situation further. First of all, thank you so much for coming on the program, Professor. It's great to have you.
You're quite welcome. Thank you for having me.
So, Professor, could I just get your initial reaction on this very tragic event, this attack that took place at Kabul Airport? You know, why did this happen? Who stands to benefit from this?
Well, it's sad, it's tragic, and it's outrageous in my view. The coverage by the corporate press has been even worse because, ever since the August 15th, when the Taliban took over the country, the entire focus of the corporate media has been on the airport, without any context, without any history, without background, without explanation, without analysis, without depth, as if the airport events, which were manufactured by by the United States and its allies as if they took place in a vacuum. There's no talk about how the United States and its allies actually deliberately created this crisis. But also there's no explanation of the contribution, direct contribution, by the previous Afghan government of Mr. Ghani and before that Mr. Karzai. So while I feel very sorry for the people and the 170 plus people who were killed and the hundreds who were injured, you know, I feel very sorry and very sad both for the expatriates who were killed and maimed and also for the Afghans. Amongst them were, I'm sure, some very important qualified, useful people, but they're gone. And also, there's no question being asked, you know, how and why this came about. And I have to, the responsibility is directly with Washington and its allies, because Washington has been meddling in Afghan affairs ever since the 1970s. While I should point out that Afghanistan had nothing to do with the crime and tragedy of 9/11, and yet the United States in October of 2001, you know, started assaulting, bombing, and occupying the country, and occupied it since August 15th. So I think, you know, while I feel sorry for the people at the airport, and they should be helped in every way, but one, we should hold the United States and allies directly responsible, and two, we should provide for a context, and three, and my question is, what about the 34 million Afghans who will be left behind? You know, suppose we, the United States and its allies, quote, rescue, you know, maybe 500,000 Afghans right now at maximum. But there are 34 million people who are, you know, destined to stay there. And what about them, their lives? Because, you know, as you know, the banks are closed. There's no money. The United States, you know, has declared the embargo. So has the IMF, the World Bank. Government employees have not been paid, you know, from 2 to 6 months before the Taliban were even in the picture. So I think we need to sort of put this in the larger context. And of course, you know, the United States, Washington needs, you know, these such scenes in trauma so that Washington can feel good and charitable and helpful, but also so that it can justify to the American public why and how it went in and why and how it got out without consulting anybody or without considering, you know, the larger picture.
And Professor, when, you know, as you say that they need such scenes, do you think that the United States or its NATO allies will exploit what just happened to maybe, you know, some people are saying they might send in more troops or start conducting, you know, expanding the war on terror? Do you think that they're going to do what they did in Iraq? They go back in under the guise of counterterrorism or going to Syria?
Well, as you know, the war continues. You know, President Biden himself said that the war over the horizon, as he put it, will continue. And we know that the United States was bombing, actually. And then 2 days yesterday, you know, the bombing of the Daesh, the two Daesh members in Nangarhar, which is understandable. But I worry because Afghanistan is so strategically located and because the United States needs Afghanistan for its resources, its geostrategic position, and also its competition and rivalry with China, Iran, and Russia. So I don't think that the United States and its so-called allies are going to sort of leave Afghanistan alone. So that's one thing. The other thing, of course, is that the United States invasion and occupation of Afghanistan, in my view, is not the first one and it's not the last one, because it's called imperialism and neocolonialism. You know, I mean, we all know what the United States has done in Central America, in Chile, in Cuba, in Central America, in Nicaragua, and in Asia and in South Africa, in Iraq, Yemen, Somalia, in Lebanon, and other places. So it's called, you know, the United States is determined actually to keep destabilizing nations and nation states who are trying to modernize themselves and also to delink themselves, their economies, societies and cultures from Western Orientalist, Eurocentrist and Islamophobia. And the United States simply cannot allow this. So I'm afraid the United States, directly or indirectly, will continue meddling in African affairs. And it's also interesting that someone in Washington said the other day that the Taliban should also involve the members of the former government. Now, we all know what Mr. Ghani did and his team and how much money they stole and is living happily in Dubai. And it looks, I think the Taliban are going to be facing several challenges. One would be the members of the warlords and also the previous Afghan government who have accumulated an enormous amount of money. They can hire any number of mercenaries and meddle the Taliban. And two, internally, as you know, Afghanistan is a very divided country. It's a very heterogeneous society. And I'm afraid that there's going to be inter-ethnic conflict, but also maybe the main conflict could be between the Pashtun, the Taliban, the Pashtuns on the one hand, and the Tajiks, Uzbeks, and Hazaras on the other hand.
You know, speaking of the Taliban, you had people like General McMaster going on CNN and saying that they worked, the Taliban allegedly worked with ISIS, with Daesh, to do this attack. I mean, they're enemies, are they not? How does that make sense? And
we should all, again, like if you look at Daesh or ISIS, and in this case called ISIS Khorasan. Khorasan means it's a former name for Afghanistan and Pakistan. But we all know that ISIS and Daesh came into being with the support of the United States in Iraq. The United States sort of provided for the emergence of the Daesh and was supporting it, and Daesh was fighting for the United States in Syria. So, and of course, but I think we should not confuse the Taliban with others, either whether it's Daesh or Tahrik-e-Taliban or the Islamic movement of Uzbekistan or the Eastern Turkestan, the Uyghurs in China. The Taliban are mostly Pashtuns, they're Afghans, they're indigenous to Afghanistan, and they have no broader international agenda beyond the borders of the Afghan. They have been on a record repeatedly saying we have no global agenda. And they should not be, I think it's wrong to sort of project them as co-terrorists because these are, they want to free their country. You know, I mean, if someone occupies your home, I think you're entitled to, defend your home and you shouldn't be named this or that. So as we know, as far as we know, there has been strong competition. In fact, I remember reading about skirmishes between the Taliban and also the Daesh, Khorasan, in Nangarhar, Kunur and Nuristan province in the southeast of Afghanistan, because the two are directly opposite. You know, the Daesh actually accuses the Taliban of being too soft on the West, but also believing in negotiations and a peaceful settlement of conflict. When the Taliban are arguing that Daesh is too extreme, non-discriminatory, and has a global agenda, and are, in a way, sort of terrorist organizations. So I don't think, not only the Taliban would not cooperate with Daesh, but in fact, Daesh would be a main challenge to the rule of Taliban because they are entirely different in their philosophy, goals and objectives, and their tactics. The Daesh is very extreme. The Taliban are not extreme.
Joe Biden, he said the U.S. has to leave because the U.S. succeeded in its counterterrorism mission. Well, if we look at the last days, that doesn't seem very true. And, you know, the Taliban have expressed a wish to establish a secure, a safe, stable Afghanistan. Do you think they're going to be able to succeed in that?
Well, I think, yes. Well, I should say to, President Biden or the U.S. government that they should not have been in Afghanistan in the first place. And if they went and attacked, they should have left in 2002 because the objective they said were then, achieved. And then they should have left, after they assassinated bin Laden in 2011 or 2010, was it, in Pakistan, not in Afghanistan. And so I think it was time. Biden would like for his own sake because Biden is in deep, deep trouble, and so are all the Democrats. So they need to get as much credit for themselves as they can. there were no terrorists, because as I said, the Taliban themselves, I think, cannot afford to either, you know, harbor or support or accommodate terrorists, because the Taliban, again, has a different trajectory and different objective. That is, they want to form a nation state. And they keep saying, you know, we need help. We need to have good relationship with the whole world. We need their assistance. You know, we need this and we need that. Again, they need credibility. So the Taliban are in no position. But, you know, Biden keeps saying, and I think in the way to deal with terrorism is a tactic. I mean, terrorism is not a group, it's not a party, it's not a government, it's not a war as such, but it's a crime. It's a crime that I think should be dealt with in other ways, through police work, intelligence, which the United States has. And actually, the Taliban have said that even they will work with the U.S. government, you know, to solve these problems. They are on record. If Washington would agree to this, you know, but Washington, as I said again, for its own reasons, is determined to destabilize and keep destabilizing Afghanistan because, as I say, this is typical imperialism, neo-colonialism, that would not allow countries to become self-sufficient, especially countries that would not make its resources, markets, and labor, and so forth, to Western imperialism. And that's the issue.
Dr. Wahab, thank you so much for your time. Really insightful, really great speaking with you.
Thank you very much, and thanks for asking me. Good luck.
In light of this tragic attack, there are several important questions, uncomfortable questions, that need to be answered. First, why did the United States move its evacuation operations to the international airport, creating a security situation with packed crowds and increasing the likelihood that an attack could happen? Just last month, on July 1st, the United States suddenly left Bagram Air Base. In the middle of the night, it cut off the power and left without even telling the Afghan security forces, who were supposed to take over, nor its own allies. Bagram Air Base is not only much more capable, but much larger than Kabul's international airport. And if the U.S. knows that thousands of people need to be evacuated, why did it abandon its biggest airbase in Afghanistan, a military, secured airbase, and go instead and hijack Kabul's international airport, a much smaller, unprotected, and much more dangerous place? This doesn't make any sense at all. Moreover, if the United States and its allies knew that a terrorist attack on the airport was imminent, why wasn't more done to secure the perimeter and prevent a tragic thing like this from happening? How can U.S. President Joe Biden and his Secretary of State, Blinken, claim that the U.S. succeeded in its counterterrorism mission in Afghanistan, and then on the way out, 170 people are killed because of a terrorist attack? That doesn't really look like the counterterrorism mission was much of a success, and certainly not the nation-building aspect of it. In response to the attack, Biden maintained that the withdrawal would continue. However, he signaled that he had authorized the U.S. military to draw up plans to strike assets and targets belonging to Daesh. The following day, it's reported that the U.S. launched a drone strike, killing two members of Daesh and wounding another. The thing is, the United States has a long history of supporting and arming terrorist groups whose objectives align with its foreign policy. For example, in the 1980s, the U.S. helped train and fund the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, some of whom went on later to form Al-Qaeda. Even Hillary Clinton admits this. And then 9/11 happens, orchestrated by the same people that the U.S. funded, and the U.S. goes to war for two decades under the guise of a war on terror. But it's a war of terror. Millions are killed, millions displaced in Iraq, in Afghanistan, and elsewhere. And even though they had nothing to do with 9/11, the U.S. goes and bombs Iraq and Afghanistan and has bombed 19 countries total. Meanwhile, the only winners left, the only people who benefited from all this, are the weapons dealers. The U.S. spent trillions of dollars. And where did those dollars go? They went to line the pockets of people who make jets, bombs, and uniforms. How convenient for them. So before the U.S. armed the Mujahideen in Afghanistan, there was no Al-Qaeda. And before the U.S. invaded Iraq and then Syria, there was no Daesh. So when the U.S. claimed it was leaving Iraq in 2011, and all of a sudden Daesh pops out of nowhere, no thanks to covert U.S. support, and of course the power vacuum which resulted after the invasion in 2003, then all of a sudden, conveniently, the U.S. has a reason to go back into Iraq. And they're still there to this day, a decade later. The U.S. entered Iraq again under the guise of counterterrorism. It claimed it will be conducting, quote-unquote, limited strikes as well inside of Syria to fight Daesh. Well, first of all, the U.S. has no permission to be in Syria. And when they said limited strikes, we know how that turned out. The U.S. has troops on the ground inside Syria, illegally occupying the country, and also controlling 90% of Syria's oil. If that's their idea of limited strikes on Daesh, what does that mean then in the case of Daesh K in Afghanistan? So one day it's Al-Qaeda, then it's Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and then it's Al-Qaeda in Syria, then it's Daesh, and now it's Daesh K. The U.S. has an extraordinary knack for finding new threats to deal with, which magically keep the war on terror going, the U.S. empire expanding, and most important of all, money flowing to the pockets of the weapons dealers. So pay attention and watch out, lest they exploit and take advantage of this latest tragedy at Kabul airport to try and prolong the war, as some of these national security ghouls and warmongers would love to do. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Richard Medhurst, and this is The Communique.
In the limelight. The region is concerned that Australia is well on its way to acquiring nuclear weapons with American and British assistance. We now present you an article written by James Chin, Professor of Asian Studies at the University of Tasmania. The piece is titled, AUKUS Sub Deal Puts ASEAN on Nuclear Edge. The article has been published by the Asia Times Daily. The announcement of a new strategic alliance between Australia, the United States and Britain, or AUKUS, has caught many by surprise. Besides France, which reacted with fury over Australia's scrapping of a major submarine deal with a French company, few countries were as surprised as Australia's neighbours to the north, the ASEAN members. In particular, Indonesia and Malaysia have come out strongly against Australia's plan to acquire a fleet of nuclear-powered submarines with the help of the United States and Britain. Even Singapore, Australia's most reliable ally in the region, has expressed concern. The Afghanistan debacle has left a bad taste among many Indo-Pacific countries, and some are wondering if the timing of the AUKUS announcement was intended as a show of U.S. power in the region to reassure jittery partners. To understand the deep anxiety in Kuala Lumpur, Jakarta, and other ASEAN capitals requires some context on where they are coming from. First, many of them think there is no such thing as acquiring nuclear-powered submarines without the prospect of acquiring nuclear weapons in the future. Australia has not joined the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which requires parties to agree not to develop, test, produce, acquire, possess, stockpile, or threaten to use nuclear weapons. The Scott Morrison government says the treaty would be inconsistent with its alliance with the United States, a nuclear weapons power. However, Australia did ratify the treaty on the non-proliferation of nuclear weapons in 1973, and the Comprehensive Nuclear Test Ban Treaty, or CNTBT, in 1998. And Australian Prime Minister Scott Morrison claimed recently Australia has no plans to pursue nuclear weapons. Some ASEAN countries are worried the AUKUS agreement is a clear signal the West will take a more aggressive stance towards China by admitting Australia to the nuclear club. Both Indonesia, the unofficial leader of ASEAN, and Malaysia fear AUKUS will also lead to a major arms race in the wider Indo-Pacific region.
The new agreement also signals that the United States, Australia, and Britain view the South China Sea as a key venue for this contest against China. The ASEAN nations have always preached maintaining Southeast Asia as a zone of peace, freedom, and neutrality, free from interference by any outside powers. In 1995, the member states of ASEAN also signed the Treaty of Southeast Asia Nuclear Weapons Free Zone, which committed to keep nuclear weapons out of the region. However, not a single nuclear power has signed onto it. Although everyone knows the United States, Britain, and France have ignored these protocols by maneuvering armed warships through the South China Sea, ASEAN does not want to see this number grow. Australian nuclear-powered submarines have the potential to change the dynamics in the South China Sea and make the Chinese much more nervous. There have already been plenty of close encounters incidents between the Chinese and the U.S. navies in the disputed waters of the South China Sea, as well as the Chinese Navy and ships belonging to ASEAN member states. The region doesn't need yet another potential close encounter to worry about.